base of yes. all these oppressive profiteers. Now, I would like you to ask yourself why the old policy of spreading phobia and hatred has targeted Islam and Muslims with an unprecedented intensity. He's asking the youth of the West to think, why does the power structure in the world power structure, want Islamic thought to be marginalised? So, why is it that that power... I mean, I'm not arguing whether the Illuminati, the New World Order exist or whether they don't exist or how powerful they are, how much power they actually do have.
That's nothing.
It could be a conspiracy.
But
it could not
it's a
be.
Really simple answer. The answer is, you don't have to think too much about this. Mm. The simple answer is, Islam is a really, really big threat for any religion, because we come with the truth. All of our belief teachings come with the truth. And what the West oppose is completely against that.
See, Ali...
So if we stand against their belief, there is no way that they can rule the world.
No.
Okay, look,
first of all, I just want to make it...
Yeah, sorry, go on.
In terms of, you're saying that they're against Islam because of the truth and so on, okay, that's fine. That's in its place. But like I said earlier, if Islam specifically... Mm-hmm. turns to the way how they want it, there is no problem. Like, for instance, look at...
I disagree.
No.
Yeah, go
look,
on.
Look how close. Uh-huh. Look how close... For example, I'll put it straight out there, as clear as it is.
Yeah.
America has very bad ties with Iran, for example.
Yeah.
They have very bad ties. But American and Western ideology has very good ties with Saudi Arabia. Why? Saudi Arabia has very big extremists, but they are very, very, very Kushti. They're very cool with them. There's no problem with them. Why?
Because Saudi Arabia is not...
Wait, America is Kushti... Sorry, is...
is happy...
With
Saudi Arabia.
Uh-huh.
With Saudi Arabia, like...
Why is that?
I know why.
No, because see, this is the point that I want to reach. Yeah, Ali, over to you.
Because...
Ali knows why.
It's really simple. Once again, my brothers, uh-huh. I'm your older brother. I will give you an easy answer.
Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you for your wisdom. Thank you,
yeah. Your overflowing wisdom.
Okay.
Yeah.
Saudi Arabia is not Islamic. All of their behavior, all of their activities go hand to hand with the West.
Okay.
Iran, it can be argued that it doesn't go. I mean, the West don't behead. Saudi
brother,
Arabia
brother,
behead.
Muzaffar.
And yet they're best of
brother,
friends.
Iran,
the West,
countries like Iran,
the West, every girl drives. Saudi
Islamic.
Arabia girls don't drive.
And yet they're best of friends.
Muzaffar. Yeah. Iran is complete 100% Islamic. So they will not shake their hands with the West. Okay.
Okay. Same.
Saudi Arabia just has your name. Brother, Saudi Arabia has the name of Islam, but behind the doors, they are complete America. Like,
first of
everything
all,
about them
Ali,
is America.
Okay, first of all, saying that everything about them is America doesn't make sense to the common people. Okay, maybe in some behind the curtain activity, maybe.
Even
I don't
in
know.
The face.
No, the face.
Where does Islam say go and behead people?
Bro,
go and crucify,
execute
people?
Let's take this back a few steps.
There are rules about this, but that's a completely different story, and there's so many... But now you've touched the story, I feel that I have to explain it a little bit. Like, in terms of beheading, first of all, it's so hard. Really, it's so hard. Like, it's almost like a paradox in Islam to actually do that to somebody.
Yeah.
It's so hard to do it.
How can you do it?
But
it's just completely un-Islamic.
But,
it's like
no, but,
you
no.
have to lose your humanity.
What kind of Islam is this?
Yeah.
The wife of Obama comes to greet the new king of Saudi Arabia and he is happily shaking her hand. She has no hijab. What kind of Islamic state is this? She has no hijab.
All right.
And she's coming to the king and she's shaking his hand.
Let's take this
brother,
a couple
come
of
on.
Steps back. No,
come
all right,
on, brother.
All right, Ali. All right.
You know?
Now, let's take this a couple
I don't
of
want
steps
to get
back.
Angry now.
Just
because
a couple
this makes
of,
me very angry.
Right, Ali, you know? we accept it. But let's just take it a couple of steps back. You said that the West or whoever the power structure is wants to destroy Islam because of the truth. Now, Christianity, we believe that Christianity, Judaism and other religions also have in their core truth. So why is it that they are not the problem and Islam is the problem?
Because it can be argued. This can also be taken as...
Because they're not standing up.
This can also be taken as a conspiracy theory that they've given up. They're priests.
Mm-hmm.
Their hierarchy, their leaders have kind of bent over.
Mm-hmm.
They're on standby.
They've bent over?
Kind of bent over, yeah. They've given in
to whatever the power structure is.
And that's the same thing that the muftis and the sheikhs of Saudi Arabia have also kind of done.
So although they pray, they fast, they read Quran...
That's fine. Nobody's got a problem against the guy who sits in the cave and prays.
Uh-huh.
But the minute the guy in the... in the cave who sits and prays and talks about love, peace, and la-di-da-di-da-di-da, the minute that guy comes out and says, hey, you know when you are doing business deals and those business deals, you're cheating the 99% and the 1% are living, but the 99%, this is an injustice. The minute the guy in the cave says that, the guy in the cave becomes a freak.
It's just obvious that all of these leaders, the Islamic Muslim leaders that claim to be Islamic, they are all corrupt. And my opinion on the Iranian government and the Islamic State in Iran, they are pure. They're not going to give their will to the American or the West. So
I think when it comes to the core of this, dear listeners, one can be Islamic without looking at the fundamentals of Islam, without looking at the core of Islam. And if you actually look at the message of Imam Hussein, it really was a message of standing up against tyranny. Other religions can be bought, other religions can be threatened and suppressed. But when you see a figure in history who not only gave up his own life, but he gave up the lives of his family, he gave up the lives of his women and his children. He sacrificed everything in the name of justice. Now, if any religion were to have a figure who was as selfless as Imam Hussein, and for that figure to be a hero who is glorified every year, the people of that religion, without a doubt, would become rebellious in their core to anything which is proclaiming injustice.
Like,
the people of the Shia school of thought would never ever stand for injustice, even if it means that we would sacrifice our own lives, the lives of our family, our women, our children. We're ready to do anything for the cause of Islam. And I think that a lot of other religions lack this. Irtaza, your closing statement.
When you talk about injustice and like how Islam kind of liberates people from that, if you understand the true meaning of Islam, I know the listeners must be like, these guys in all over the world, Muslims go on about the true meaning of Islam, the true meaning of Islam. What is the true meaning of Islam? That my brothers and sisters and whoever you are, you will have to find yourself with a pure heart. Like, people can guide you, but you like the letter says, think yourself.
At the end
and
of the day,
I know we're running out of time, but one thing I really wanted to mention, I don't know if it fits in well, but anyway, I feel it had to be mentioned, was if you just look back when Malcolm X came out and spoke out, when he came out and spoke out, this guy also went and became Muslim. Mm-hmm. But when he came out and spoke out against injustice.
Yeah.
It's always this trend. Like, for instance, people could say, no, they hate the Muslims. No, they didn't like Malcolm X as well. He spoke against injustice.
Yeah. Yeah,
Gandhi
absolutely.
Spoke against injustice.
Absolutely.
Yeah? Like, Che Guevara talks against injustice.
Yeah. In that sense, they're more Muslim than the Muslims who sit and pray. The letter of Ayatollah Khamenei says, my second request is that in reaction to the flood of prejudgments and disinformation campaigns, try to gain a direct and first-hand knowledge of this religion. And I think that is the tagline which ties our conversation together. I'd just like to end with this verse from the Holy Quran, which is chapter 5, verse 69, which says, surely those who believe and those who are Jews and the Sabians and the Christians, whoever believes in Allah and the last day and does good, they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve. We hope that you have enjoyed listening to us. From myself, Muzaffar Abbas Haider.
From me, Irtaza Rezavi.
And from me, Brother Ali Shah.
If you do have any questions or queries for myself, Irtaza Rizvi, or Ali Shah, do feel free to email us at coi@irib.ir.
A letter for you.
A letter for you from the Scotland.
Forget it, man. This has been A Letter For You, and we hope you have enjoyed listening. And we hope... Assalamu alaikum.
A letter for you.
And this is a letter written by the leader of the Muslim Ummah.
Special program on the message of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei to the youth in Europe and North America.
Round the world with reporters. Revocation of autonomous status, unprecedented security clampdown, then the COVID pandemic. Last 17 months have been full of darkness and uncertainty in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The months-long lockdown has left the region's economy shattered. According to official statistics, the economy suffered losses of over $5 billion. Tourism industry, which is considered the mainstay of Kashmir's economy, has been one of the worst sufferers. Now, following months of lull, Kashmir's tourist hubs are coming back to life. Winter snow has brought tourists back to the picturesque Himalayan region and raised hope among those associated with the tourism industry. The world-famous ski resort Gulmarg is abuzz with tourists these days.
The losses are humongous. And as far as expectation is concerned, Kashmir tourism is all about hope and expectations. I mean, for the last 20-25 years, entire world knows that we have been running tourism in very, very challenging situations.
Tourism industry, particularly hoteliers in Kashmir, suffered huge losses, first due to scrapping of Article 370 and then due to global pandemic. New Year has brought glamour of hope with tourists returning to Kashmir.
Yeah, this is the first time I'm here. I'm very happy from the core of my heart. I always feel like I'm on the ninth cloud.
The tourism department is organizing various events in a bid to attract more tourists in order to revive the industry. After Winter Games, Gulmarg is now hosting snow sculpting competition, braving sub-zero temperature. The participants are working with great passion to produce some of the finest works of art. Meanwhile, a 31-member Indian parliamentary delegation is also here to promote tourism. The visiting delegation also met various stakeholders of the region's tourism sector. Situated at an altitude of 2,730 meters above sea level, Gulmarg boasts of one of the highest cable cars in the world. With breathtaking slopes, Gulmarg is one of the finest ski destinations in the world and the heartland of winter sports in India.
Wrapped in a thick carpet of snow, the ski resort of Gulmarg presents a delightful picture these days. It offers best slopes for skiers and attracts sports and adventure lovers from across the world, and also raises hopes for tourism revival in Kashmir. Sidri Safi from Gulmarg Ski Resort, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The 25th edition of Iran's oil, gas, refining and petrochemical exhibition is held in Tehran. Many Iranian companies that are active in oil and gas industry couldn't show their latest products and achievements. Several senior officials from the country's oil industry also attended the opening ceremony of the show. This year, the exhibition was held under the slogan of National Oil, Iranian Goods and Services with a focus on domestic production.
We are a leading provider of infrastructure, technology and construction services in Iran. We specialize in engineering, procurement, and construction of LPG storage tanks. And we have completed several projects in South Pars region and Kharg and Siri Islands.
The three-day exhibition covered a range of oil-related fields, including upstream industries, startups, petrochemicals and related industries, gas industry, pipes and tubes, and refining and distribution.
Our company is an engineering and manufacturing company, active in field of gas turbines, steam turbines, and centrifugal compressors. We typically work on a package of industrial line of a gas turbine and steam turbine and a package of a compressor. We typically do manufacturing and design of components and parts, and also provide services for overhaul and maintenance of these equipments only in oil and gas industries.
We produce facilities for gas stations, including dispensers and underground tanks. All our productions are indigenous, and we export them to several regional countries. We also build mobile dispensers and rapid installed stations.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's oil show is one of the major oil and gas events in the world in terms of the number of participants.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, this year's oil show is not open to the public, and only managers, businessmen, and experts are allowed to visit the exhibition. Human Abadi, Tehran.
The number of people sleeping on the streets at night across the European Union is growing by the day amid the pandemic. Welfare systems are under enormous strain. We have been speaking to one homeless man in Brussels who is finding it difficult to acquire emergency accommodation.
It's very hard in the cold, in the winter. It's very hard to feel good, to find somewhere. It's very difficult.
A debate on the worsening social crisis in the EU resulting from COVID-19 has been held in the European Parliament.
We have a problem here. The slow, sluggish bureaucracy of the European Union is not compatible with emergencies like the one we face today.
Governments in the EU are being urged to submit pandemic recovery plans to the European Commission so that €750 billion in available funding can be released without any further delay.
Millions of people lost already their jobs. And they are mainly the low-skilled, the low-paid workers, the temporary workers, the young on precarious work.
The European Parliament debate was told the EU social crisis could last for many years unless action is taken to save economies.
Thousands of businesses have temporarily or permanently closed. Millions of Europeans have lost their jobs and livelihoods.
Many EU legislators say the 27-country bloc's vaccination programme is being delivered too slowly. To make matters worse, experts in the UK are suggesting the new variant of COVID-19, discovered last year in England, might be more deadly than previously thought. EU officials are concerned new variants of the disease might be resistant to approved vaccines and vaccines awaiting approval. With that comes obvious health concerns, but also incredible economic uncertainty. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics, ISTAT, has found that large swaths of mostly young and highly educated Italians have continued to move abroad in search of working opportunities. Italy's young workers have been living for decades. However, the report has highlighted that over 300,000 Italians aged 18 to 39 emigrated to neighboring European countries and overseas between 2015 and 2019, up 33% compared to 2014. One in three of them were graduates.
These figures show that young Italians, particularly from the rich north, choose to leave the country because the labor market doesn't offer them any prospects. This is why young people from the depressed Italy south continue to emigrate to northern cities. We are calling on the government to invest more in the youth, in its recovery and resilience plan, the investment project using European Union funds to counter the effect of the pandemic.
Youth unemployment level in Italy stands at about 40%. Furthermore, 3 out of 10 Italians between 18 and 24 years of age are not in employment, education or training, the third highest percentage among OECD countries.
A recent study by the European Commission has found that Italy, along with Poland and Romania, is among the European countries that send the most workers abroad. This brain drain costs Italy an estimated €14 billion every year.
It's an inconceivable waste. Once trained through our school system, our young Italians offer their skills to foreign countries. It's true, our labor market is stagnant, but it must be said that quite often the system does not reward merit.
Successive Italian governments had long tried attracting back talented workers with tax breaks, with no success. However, a counter-exodus of the brain drain seems to be underway since the start of the pandemic. Data from Italy's foreign ministry shows that in 2020, the number of young Italians returning home increased about 20% over the previous year. Max Civili, Rome.
Wow.
A London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission made a plea with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, reminding the illegal grounds on which top cleric Sheikh Zazaki and his wife were being kept in prison. Simultaneously, the Islamic Human Rights Commission has also written to the United Nations asking the international body to exert pressure on Nigeria to do the same. Lawyer to the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, has expressed shock that 7 days after testing positive to COVID-19, Zazaki's wife, Zinat, is yet to be hospitalized. Also in a press conference, the Islamic movement in Nigeria said that keeping Malama Zinat in Kaduna prison without hospitalization has violated the known guidelines and protocols for the prevention of the spread of COVID-19.
The task force for the COVID-19 pandemic, they went around even sharing, distributing contacts that whenever you see somebody affected, you should call them, they will come and immediately evacuate such a person for treatment. But that of Malama Zina, she's there for 7 days. Till today, she's still in the prison custody.
In December 2015, security forces attacked Zazaki's house and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters and 3 of his biological children. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said it will continue to demand justice for Sheikh Zazaki and his wife.
We call on the masses to join us in calling for justice. We call on the relevant authorities to respect the law of the land and immediately and unconditionally release the corpse, as courts has ordered for their immediate release.
Zazaki's son, Muhammad, said up to now, his mother, Zinat, is still in Kaduna prison and is yet to be hospitalized. The Islamic movement in Nigeria and Zazaki's son are both calling on the authorities to ensure that she receives proper medical care and to release Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife with immediate effect. Ranjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
Travel agents in 13 different countries should get ready for a rush of customers. The United States has finally lifted its shockingly xenophobic and unprecedented travel ban. Iran was one of 6 other Muslim-majority nations which were primarily targeted, which caused ex-President Donald Trump's executive order to become called the Muslim Travel Ban, informally and infamously. New President Joe Biden ended the ban on his first day in office. The bigotry lasted 4 years, and the damage to American citizens, countless non-Americans, and America's image cannot be overestimated.
The real shame in this is not simply turning our back on, America's tradition of not judging people on the basis of their religion or our constitutional prohibition against that. But what's really, troubling about this is that we have gone through this process where family members have not been able to be together with loved ones.
Husbands and wives have been kept apart for years. Grandparents passed away without seeing their newborn grandchildren. Weddings, graduations, birthdays, funerals, jobs, business deals, educational exchanges. The accumulation of grief and difficulty caused by the Islamophobic ban is appalling. In many ways, the ban backfired, because it emphatically demonstrated the scope and reach of state-sponsored Islamophobia, something which had been routinely denied by the right and the left, not only in the United States, but across the West.
It's really going to require that we go through the hard work of actually implementing policies, not just in travel, but in other ways that fight against Islamophobia, because we know that it has been a feature in our society, certainly for the last 30 years, but even long before that.
The ban led to doctor shortages in a United States which would soon be unable to handle the coronavirus pandemic. It also put a pause on the so-called brain drain, which allows America to stay near the forefront of science and technology. Trump's dehumanizing of Muslims followed years of scapegoating in order to rationalize the wars across the Muslim world started by Trump's predecessors, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Perhaps above all, the ban showed that in the American system, it is still possible to codify racism into law. the Supreme Court reversed a series of lower court decisions which allowed the ban to go into effect. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Slim hopes of progress towards peace in Yemen were swiftly dashed this month as former US President Donald Trump designated Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization before he left office. A move widely condemned as deeply damaging to the peace process and pushing the country towards a possible new famine. Amid fears for Yemen's future, I secured an exclusive interview with the foreign minister of the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a for a response to these disturbing developments.
The US is not an international organization or some kind of an institution that has the right to designate someone as terrorist or not terrorist. The US should always be concerned about its affairs, not trying to be the guardian of the whole world.
The foreign minister explained that he felt the US decision was silly and that Trump was probably paid into making the choice.
I think the Trump administration decision was something paid for. And you will see it in the near future. It's something paid for to say certain things or to take some actions. So again, from our side, we are not concerned about that, and we will not deal with it.
I asked the foreign minister whether Yemen would consider a military response. He warned that if the peace process totally fails, Yemen is strong enough to fight back.
If such peace fails, we are ready for all circumstances. And our choices are wide open. And by the way, we can affect and do what we want. We are so strong to the point that we can change the whole scenario, but we will not do it for the sake of the Yemeni people.
The foreign minister also sent a message to the new US President Joe Biden.
If Biden has the courage, and I think he does, they should make an announcement that this war is over. They stop the support of the Saudis and the Emiratis and any other people involved, and the war will stop. And Mr. Biden, maybe later on, will get the Nobel Prize that Trump was running after. Now Biden should run after it.
It's been reported that Biden's foreign policy team disagrees with the terror designation and that many of Trump's policies will be reversed in quick succession. But even if the US ends its support for the Saudi coalition's aggression, peace may be unachievable so long as the Ansarullah-held areas are sanctioned. Robert Carter, London.
French President Emmanuel Macron has rolled out issuing an official apology for the atrocities committed by French troops in Algeria. In a statement, Macron's office said there will be no repentance or apologies for the occupation of Algeria or the deadly eight-year war that ended 132 years of French rule in the North African country. Algeria has been demanding a formal apology for years for France's colonial-era war crimes. The French presidency, however, said France will instead endeavor to face up to its history. The statement comes ahead of the publication of a major government commission report on how France has dealt with its colonial past in the North African country. The report offers proposal to address long-standing grievances, but it skirts the issue of systematic torture by French troops and does not recommend an official apology. France occupied Algeria in 1830. The African country gained independence following the Algerian War of 1954 to 1962. The war is also known as the Algerian Revolution. Algerian historians put the death toll at 1.5 million Algerian victims, while the French historians say around 400,000 people from both sides were killed in the conflict. The truth of the colonization and the War of Independence lay buried for decades. During his presidential campaign in 2017, Macron called the colonization of Algeria a crime against humanity. In September 2018, he officially acknowledged for the first time the widespread use of torture by French forces in the former colony. However, like his predecessors, Macron has so far refrained from issuing a formal apology for his country's colonial past. But grievances tied to the colonial history have weighed on French national integration since many French citizens are Muslims of Algerian descent. As former Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner admitted in 2008, there seems to be a permanent contradiction between human rights and the foreign policy of France. The country's dark history of human rights violations and supporting dictators, especially in Africa and West Asia, serves as a proof of Kouchner's remark that a French foreign policy is not based on human rights. France's support for former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during his invasion of Iran in the 1980s, its support for Libya's longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi before his ouster in 2011, and the country's arms sales to Saudi Arabia while the kingdom is involved in the brutal war on Yemen are all indicative of such a policy. It so appears that human rights is only a weapon in the hands of French politicians to target nations that do not get along with their policies.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
As reports emerge across the U.S. of health facilities throwing out unused and spoiled COVID-19 vaccines, some state governments are failing to track the wastage as required by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, leaving officials coordinating immunization efforts blind to exactly how many of the precious limited doses are going into the trash and why. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written jointly by Ryan Gabrielson, Caroline Chen, and Molly Simon researchers. This article is published under the heading, Several U.S. States Aren't Counting How Many Vaccine Shots Go to Waste. Here's the details. As reports emerge across the U.S. of health facilities throwing out unused and spoiled COVID-19 vaccines, some state governments are failing to track the wastage as required by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, leaving officials coordinating immunization efforts blind to exactly how many of the precious limited doses are going into the trash and why. In Washington, a health facility allegedly threw out some COVID-19 vaccine doses at the end of the workers' shifts because the staff believed state guidelines blocked them from giving unused shots to people below the top priority tier. In Maryland, workers appear to have tossed thawed doses when they ran out of time to administer them safely. How many doses exactly have been wasted in those states is unknown because neither state is tracking unused or wasted vaccines. In Indiana, where hospitals have told the media about discarding some shots, the state health department said it requires wastage to be reported but wasn't able to tell ProPublica how many doses have been tossed statewide. Nonetheless, it asserted that wastage has been minimal. Experts say waste reporting is essential during a vaccination campaign to encourage careful handling and the use of every viable dose and, more importantly, to identify potential problems in the shipping and cold storage operations. With inconsistent reporting requirements and no enforcement of a federal mandate to report wastage, vaccine providers have little incentive to acknowledge wasting vaccines, said Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University. Jha said he thinks that the true number of wasted doses across the U.S. is far higher than a handful. After he detailed one anecdote, he heard about an ER physician forced to waste vaccine doses in a thread on Twitter. His phone quickly filled with more than a dozen messages from other medical workers, confirming what he suspected. At a time when the U.S. is desperately short on vaccines, a significant number of doses are ending up in the trash. Clinics and hospitals have gotten slammed when the media has learned of them wasting even a few doses, he said. And the signal to everybody else is, if you have waste, don't report it, because if you do, you're gonna get into a lot of trouble. That combination means, at least in my assessment, there is a lot of waste and a lot of underreporting of that waste. The CDC requires all organizations that administer the vaccine to report the number of vaccine doses that were unused, spoiled, expired, or wasted, as required by the relevant jurisdiction. The CDC also asked the states to describe their wastage monitoring method during the distribution planning process. Vaccine providers such as pharmacies and hospitals are supposed to provide data on wasted doses to their state health agencies, which then send the information to the CDC. Like many parts of the vaccine rollout, that has not gone according to plan. State by state, ProPublica found, reporting requirements vary and are not reliably communicated to vaccine providers. Even when the rules are clear, they're not regularly enforced, nor are numbers reported to the public. Maryland Hospital Association said wastage data is not systematically collected, while the state's health department said that unless they are reported to us, MDH does not track specific instances of accidental vaccine wastage at the local level. A Washington State Health Department spokesperson said that the state does not systematically capture wasted dose information. The spokesperson added that providers are encouraged to use up all of the shots they receive and that if a provider doesn't have enough qualifying employees under the top priority group, they can help vaccinate workers who aren't receiving vaccine directly from their employers. Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services said, "We have not asked that vaccine providers report this data, though it said that 10 wasted doses had been reported to it as of January 13th. In some cases, the state said they were aware of specific instances of wastage. New Jersey said that it was aware of 16 vials that had to be discarded because they arrived broken when the boxes were open." While a spokesperson noted that providers are instructed to give vaccines to people on wait lists to minimize the chances of vaccine being discarded, the spokesperson didn't respond to questions about whether providers were mandated to report wasted doses. Other states do have wastage reporting mandates. Pennsylvania, for example, said it requires providers to report any doses that are received and are not able to be used and was able to give a percentage. 0.1% of doses received for injections as of January 11th that had to be disposed of. The majority of discarded vaccine is related to vials broken in handling and syringe issues, such as bent or broken needles, or clients refusing after the vaccine dose was drawn, said Department of Health spokesman Barry Sisokipo. Colorado also said that the waste is being tracked. The state is aware that the Papa Local Public Health rendered 300 doses of vaccine unusable after a portable vaccine storage unit malfunction. A spokesperson from the State Joint Information Center said. In every mass vaccination effort, some share of doses unavoidably goes into the trash rather than arms. However, data on wasted shots, especially in large quantities, is an essential tool for federal and state health agencies trying to spot problems in how the vaccine is being shipped, stored, and given to the public. State vaccine officials monitor wastage numbers to determine if providers are mishandling shipments or improperly maintaining the temperature of their vials, said Dr. Kelly Moore, deputy director of the Immunization Action Coalition and former head of Tennessee's immunization program. Are they tracking things and responding appropriately? If you're seeing extremely high wastage rates and everything is always perfect, Moore said, when things look too good to be true, they usually are. Complicating the count is the fact that the number of doses available in a vial sometimes exceeds the amount prescribed on the label. Pharmacies have commonly found that they can squeeze a 6-dose out of vaccine vials, even though they are labeled as containing 5. That meant a vaccine site could be allocated a certain number of doses on paper, have a few extra ones left that need to be tossed, and still come out net positive. In that situation, it is unclear if the discarded doses should count as waste.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints and Analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
And Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me here.
So, in these series of the program Viewpoints produced by Brother Mahmoud, we are dedicating our discussions to some of the most important speeches of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei regarding different occasions. And since these days, especially in the month of Bahman, which is the 11th month according to the solar calendar in Islamic Republic of Iran, a very big event took place about 42 years ago. And that was the Islamic Revolution of Iran, which we can say led to the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran, founded by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. There are so many discussions regarding the Islamic Republic of Iran and Islamic Revolution. Of course, this revolution is a rough translation for what happened as Enghilab in Iran, because usually revolution has a negative connotation, but this Enghilab was a change, a political change, social change, religious change inside Iran, and now we know it, this country, all across the world, the United Nations, by the name Islamic Republic of Iran, or the Islamic Republic of Iran. Okay, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, first of all, let's get to the main sources for this revolution. Now, here and there, everybody knows that the thoughts of Imam Khomeini had direct role in establishing such an authority. Maybe some people think that it started in 1978 and then took place in 1979. But Imam Khomeini's movement had started very much earlier. And if we want to talk about his ideology, Imam Khomeini's ideology in establishing a government and a state for Iran, how do you define it for us, and how do you give us a picture of his ideology?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Imam Khomeini was a man of Islam, and he was truly a follower of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wa salam. The main ideology behind the Islamic State of Iran, or Islamic Republic of Iran, we can say, like this revolution that happened, was to apply the Muhammadan Islam in the society. There are many societies, there were many Muslim countries, but they all were lacking Muhammadan Islam, the true Islam that was there. And although we can see, like Raza Shah, who has a Muslim name, who looks like a Muslim, but obviously the rules that were obviously that were applied in this country, in this state, were non-Islamic. Obviously, he banned the hijab. His father banned the hijab.
That's right.
And
known as kashfe hijab in Iran.
Kashfe hijab.
That's right.
Known as kashfe hijab.
Okay.
And obviously, alcohol was allowed.
Mm-hmm.
There were no security for the people. People couldn't have their religious, we can say, like
gatherings. That's right.
Freely. So there was no freedom of, we can say, like religion mm-hmm. within this country that was known as an Islamic country, like okay. Iran. So the main aim was to give this freedom, the religious freedom, to the people, and give the security to them, like when they're performing this.
Okay.
And in order to do that, obviously, we have to go back to where's the actual Islam, the Muhammadan Islam. We need to follow Quran.
That's right.
So the main basis of this revolution was to basically to bring back the Quran and the Sirah, or the Sunnah of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
That's right.
In the Islamic State.
But the main question is that we can say, maybe when we say Islamic, some people believe that it must be 100% Islamic. I mean, if you look at, for example, a society, it must be all the Islamic laws are observed. Or no, it is very difficult. I mean, well, acting according to the Sharia of Islam,
yes,
is very difficult, even in our personal lives, let alone to the
you
social
know,
arena.
When I did not came to Iran, we used to think like there is no stealing in Iran, no one steals anything,
okay.
There is no robbery, nothing.
Okay.
So we used to look at the Islamic Republic of Iran like this. But obviously we need to remember that the Islamic rules are there by the governments,
mm-hmm.
by the leader, by, for example, the Wali Faqih.
That's right.
Or the, we can say, like the assembly, they bring all the rules.
Yes.
But do the people follow them or not, they're free.
Mm-hmm.
There is no one like behind you who has the hunter, for example.
Hunter game. There is no yeah. hunter game.
I think, Sid, you could actually have another imagination about the Islamic Republic, because at the time that even the Holy Prophet was managing his own government,
people were,
weren't you expecting anyone, for example, to steal
yes.
something, or on whom was the hudud were actually implementing?
Okay,
it means that even at the time of the Holy Prophet, while he was the actually creator of this foundation, Even in his own government, he performed hudud and he did qasas, and
they were hypocrites.
So we should not expect such a thing even from the Islamic Republic.
I know,
though
generally
it is good. It is good to have it in
yes.
our
the way
plans,
brother,
inshallah, to reach that.
The way Brother Atta has said, like people think like 100% there should be everything Islamic, nothing should be wrong.
Do you know why
I think it's good to even
it's in the people's
because
you know?
Because when you're establishing a political system based on Islamic Sharia, it will be very difficult to run it, especially in the 21st century.
I think this
in
is 20, one of
the 21st century,
uh-huh.
because you know what is known is that, as I told you, on that time, liberal capitalism was active from one side, the communism was active, and in both these systems, you do not see any religion or any religious type of thinking, okay? They absolutely believe in the separation from the, we can say, the church and the state or mosque and the state, okay? So what I say is that when you are running a society and a country according to Islamic Sharia, it will be very much difficult. And at the same time, updating the Islamic Sharia based on the needs of the day is very important. This is what Imam Khomeini was after.
There are lots of things to be said, even yes. in this very point that you mentioned, yes. in this word, updating, yeah. updating up to how much updating? Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, does it mean changing the rules?
No, there are some limits. Yeah. Within the limits, you okay. need to bring reform.
What were the main values the people were after and following the maktab of Imam Khomeini, Brother Ali? There must be some values. We know that when you look at the Pahlavi regime in Iran at that time, the universities, road making, industry, economy, political scene, having international relations with the other countries, okay? These were all there and now are available too. But Imam Khomeini somehow introduced some new concepts and values to the society. What were those values?
Before going to your question, I'd like to comment on the previous point that you have been talking about respected Sayyid. And that was, I wanted to answer the question that you were talking about with a comment by the current leader of the Islamic Ummah, Ayatollah Khamenei. Once he was asked that, are you leading an Islamic community? Are you leading an Islamic country? And are you trying your best to implement Islamic laws? Mm-hmm. And can you claim that this country that you are actually leading is an Islamic country? The leader replied, I think it was a young guy that he was answered by the leader that, look, we are trying to bring all the Islamic rules. We are on the way to make it perfect, but there are lots of obstacles on the way. We don't claim that we are a fully Islamic country at the moment, but we are trying our best to reach to that point to become an Islamic state. Mm-hmm. So claiming a country or a community to be Islamic is not an easy thing, brother, because there are lots of things that needs to come together and actually find a sort of convergence to make it Islamic. Even as I mentioned and said to the brother, even at the time of the Prophet, Muslims wanted to live Islamically. But there were some that who were against and hypocrites who were making obstacles on the way of Muslims, on the way of performance of Islamic laws. So in the course of history, we found these issues, and even for today, we want to actually implement all the Islamic and religious laws in our country. Mm-hmm. But the issues and events that comes to us, like, for example, 8 years of That's imposed right. war, then later sanctions, and different issues, they target this Islamic and new and young tree of the Islam.
We know that at the first 3 years of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, civil wars took place in the streets of Iran. And the system, had fought different groups.
Yeah.
We have missed so many of our ulama and our thinkers at the very beginning in assassinations and in bomb explosions. And these are, vandalisms that took place. After that, we got 8-year war with Iraq. Mm-hmm. And these were all at the very beginning. As you said, this political system was very young, mm-hmm. was a teenage maybe. Yes, okay, sir. And all these events took place.
Yeah, back to your question concerning what
the values.
The values that actually were lacked by the previous regime and were seen in this current government as in the new mm-hmm. governments after the revolution. I can actually enlist some of the values that, inshallah, we can actually discuss them later in depth. One was the people's vote and public authority were not mm-hmm. seen in the outcome of the government.
That's right.
There were some elections. I don't want to say that there was no election at all, but these elections very limited and special people could enter. Not like today. Like now we see that a person from a far village in one far part of Iran can nominate for the, let's say, for the parliament,
election.
For the parliament, or parliament. Even for the even presidential election.
If he has got higher studies,
if
yes.
he has, okay. I mean, the requirements of that. Mm-hmm. So it, we couldn't see such things at the time of. I mean, the Shah's
king
system, before
the
revolution. The
monarchy system.
So the people's votes were not seen to that level. We have witnessed and we have even to some extent sensed these things at the time of these two kings, and specifically at the time of last two kings. Second was the religious beliefs of the people were not actually taken into
respected.
Account and were not respected. I remember that sometimes people, in order to make a congregation and an assembly for the Azaa, for example, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they were trying to hide it in from different parts in order to enter the place. So it was a part of their religion, and majority of the people were the same. I mean, were having the same beliefs. So how come in a country of, for example, at that time, 95% of Shias were not free to actually pay attention or to work on their own Islamic or religious
okay.
beliefs? So they had such limitations. For ladies and women, while entering, I mean, offices and official places, and also mm-hmm. and even the schools for the girls and youngsters, they were actually banned to enter such places with full Islamic hijab and covering. But even on the contrary, they were asked to remove their hijab. So these are the things that when you stand in front of the belief or religion and the habits of a people and
That's
a nation,
right.
so it will not help you to
also
continue.
The social political pressures on the, we can say, artists and also politicians at that time was really high. We know that so many politicians were, we can say, that's right,
very
killed.
True. But in case you ask a person, for example, today, that mm-hmm. To compare the, let's say, the beliefs of the people from before and after revolution, mm-hmm. since we always have a good idea of what has been in the past, we might say that, okay, no, at that time people were more religious.
Nostalgia.
I don't want to say that people were not that religious,
mm-hmm.
but the growth of religious beliefs
yeah,
in
and
our
rituals,
and
rituals
and spirituality
right.
after revolution cannot be compared to
that's
whatever
right.
we have.
And this
we
is
have
natural because
the
system
before
is,
revolution.
Yeah, okay, that's all right. In comparison to the past, this is not only limited to Iran; all around the world.
Yeah.
The people have the nostalgia, you know,
yeah.
this nostalgic feeling of the past was better,
yeah.
and now the present is better. But now the present
and
be
one
the
good
past
sample
for
the of
future.
It, brother. One good sample and example of it is the imposed war. We have seen that
yes.
the growth of this spirituality
yeah.
made those youngsters to go to the battlefronts and actually
okay.
sacrifice themselves
okay.
for the nation and for the Islam.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Brother Ali and Said Mohsen Naqvi, for presence in the program. Viewpoints. We'll get to some of the most important mottos and slogans of the Islamic Revolution of Iran as preached by Imam Khomeini in an upcoming session of the program. Dear listeners, visit our website, parstree.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you. Afi Amanallah.
قام الإمام قام الإمام
قام الإمام
وقامت برايا وكر الأنام كر الأنام
قام الإمام
جماهير إيران في صحوة تداعت إلى الساح وسط الزحام
وقامت أسودا تلبي الخمين نداء السماء وغيث الغمام
وعاد الإمام إلى أرضه ليملأ عدلا بلاد الكرام.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.